Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The budget hyperbole is getting thicker than usual, even for an election year.
On January 1st, 2013, there's going to be a massive fiscal cliff.
We've got to stop this notion that we can just keep taking more and more and more from families and businesses to spend us deeper into debt.
Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke predict catastrophe if something is not done now to reduce the amount of debt the federal government is accumulating. It's pressing because Congress and its so-called super committee last year could not figure out a way to cut the deficit. The penalty of that inaction is automatic cuts of $1.2 trillion, half to defense, half to the rest of the budget, unless there is a compromise. Those cuts would take effect January 1st. Thus, all the rhetoric. To help us get the real story, Wall Street economics editor David Wessel has a new book. It's called Red Ink. It lays out how we got so deeply in debt, where the money is going, and what it's going to take to erase that debt. David Wessel, welcome to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
The U.S. government, you write, spends $400 million an hour. How on earth can we spend that much money?
Well, it is an overwhelming number, and one of the things I try and do in the book is to break it down into pieces because I was struck once by something that humor columnist Dave Barry wrote, that the reason people can't understand the federal budget is that trillions and billions and millions sound too much alike. And we ought to talk about golf balls, watermelon, and hot air balloons, and it would be clearer. I mean, basically what's happened over the last 70 years is we've relied more and more and more on the government for things. Back in 1931, the federal spending was about 5% of the size, or less than 5% of the size of the economy. Today, it's been averaging over 20%. It's because we want more from the government. We have Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, and a lot bigger federal government than we did when Roosevelt was elected, for instance, 70 years ago.
But we don't have enough money to pay for it. That's the problem. It's not that we're spending a lot of money. It's just that, well, that's half the problem, I guess, is that we're not raising the revenue to pay for all the programs that we now enjoy.
Right. Well, there are people who think that the problem is that spending is too big and it hurts the economy. But I think you're right that the reason this is approaching a dangerous level now is that for every dollar we spent last year, we borrowed 36 cents of it. And most of that came from, or about half of that came from abroad, and about half of that from China. So even though interest rates are very, very low now, extraordinarily low, we're spending about 6% of all federal spending on interest this year. But the president's budget says that by 2017, which is only 5 years away, even if everything works out the way he hopes, the share of interest in the federal budget will have doubled to 12%. In just 5 years, because he expects interest rates to return to normal.
Our question for our listeners, what real sacrifice are you willing to make to reduce the federal deficit? Give us a call. Our phone number is 292-8513. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. Our guest is author David Wessel, economics editor for the Wall Street Journal. You hear him on NPR frequently. He's got a new book, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. You write that the best way to measure how much the deficit, how much the debt has grown is to look at government spending as a percentage of the gross domestic product rather than just dollars adjusted for inflation. How has it grown when you look at that measurement?
Right. Well, one thing I find that people have a hard time understanding is the difference between the word deficit and the word debt. So let me just pause there for 1 minute. The deficit is how much more we spent each year than we take in. That's the cash flow of the government. The debt, D-E-B-T, is the accumulation of all the past deficits, because every year we have to borrow a little more. The spending as a percentage of GDP has risen pretty steadily. It was, you know, roughly about a little only over about 15% in 1950, and now because the recession has caused the government to spend so much more, it's up to about 25% of GDP. I mean, the government has definitely gotten bigger, and the problem is that revenues haven't kept pace with that. We were running a deficit even before the Great Recession. The Great Recession made it worse. That's not the problem. the fundamental problem is that, and this is to quote Doug Elmendorf, who's the head of the Congressional Budget Office, the fundamental problem is that Americans want more in benefits than they're willing to send to Washington in taxes.
When did this deficit spending begin? When did it become part of the normal operation of the federal government to borrow 36 cents of every dollar we're spending?
Well, 36 cents is a pretty big number in historical thing, but basically this dates to the beginning of the Reagan years in the 1980s when deficits began to become a permanent feature of the American economy, even in good times. Partly that's because the Reagan philosophy was that if you cut off the government's allowance, then the government would spend less. So we had these big tax cuts in the beginning of the Reagan years, and the economy did pretty well, but spending did not really come down that much, and then we had big deficits. The deficits went away, as you remember, at the end of the 90s for a while, partly because we raised taxes and partly because of the peace dividend that came from the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. But that turned out to be a fleeting moment.
Now, a lot of Republicans will point to the expansion of government by Franklin Roosevelt and then Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. How much can we lay at their feet?
A lot. Both of them expanded government. FDR did it during a depression, but he did things that lasted a long time afterwards. And Lyndon Johnson really completed the FDR New Deal agenda by expanding Medicare or creating Medicare for the elderly and the disabled and Medicaid for the poor. But there are a lot of Republican fingerprints on this. Richard Nixon he'd be considered a liberal now, what he did with federal spending. And, of course, one of our recent problems is the expansion of Medicare to cover prescription drugs without showing any way to pay for it. And that was signed into law by George Bush.
George W.
II.
Bush, yeah.
George W. II.
Yeah, so both parties basically are equally or partially to blame for what's happening here.
Yes, right. And to the extent that one of them has sinned and the other one may have had a better position, a fiscally responsible position, the fact that they've been unable to reach any compromise and resolve their differences so we're not facing this this big deficit, as far as the eye can see, is really a plague on both their houses, I think.
Our guest, David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. We're trying to get down to the facts, get beyond the rhetoric of the debate over the federal deficit and then the federal debt, and just look at the numbers. Where is the money going, and where is it coming in? What are we paying for, and who's paying for it? David, two-thirds of the budget you write is on autopilot. What does that mean?
Well, what happens is that the Congress has made a number of promises to pay benefits like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans, farm subsidies, and, of course, the interest on the federal debt. And so every year when they come in, they have all these promises they've made, and they spend the rest of the year arguing about the rest of the budget. 63% of the budget last year went to these promises, sometimes called entitlements. In 2009, as an observation that an economist named Gene Sterley made, the federal government had actually committed all of the nation's tax revenue before Congress actually came to work. It's not that they can't change these things, but it's that they're not forced to reexamine them every year, the same way they are, say, the size of the defense budget or how many federal employees to have.
What would it take to get them to reexamine these things, to get it off on the pilot?
Well, you could have some kind of budget for healthcare, and you could say if we are spending more than such and such on healthcare, we'll have to reexamine our programs. Or, as we've tried sometimes in the past, you set some targets for spending and deficits, and if it looks like spending is going to exceed those targets, then you try to build some rules into getting Congress to deal with it. But fundamentally, the problem is that it's easy to hard programs to tweak in the short term. And what we really need is a kind of more farsighted look at these programs. And you hear some discussion about this. I think there's widespread agreement among Democrats and Republicans that healthcare spending is a big part of the problem. Healthcare spending was less than 10% of the budget in 1960. It's 25% today, and it's on the road to 33% by the end of the decade. So in that sense, they have a common diagnosis, but they have no agreement on what to do about it and how fast.
Let's look at health care. That is a major, as you just mentioned, source of spending, cause of spending by the federal government. How has that become? It's really kind of almost When you're going to spend a third of the money on health care, can you say it's out of control? Is that too
strong?
Yeah,
it's out of control. It's out of control. But I think you have to look at what happened here, because what happened helps you decide what you need to do about it. One is the government covers more and more people. So it's not surprising that it spends more money. And that's going to go up a lot because there are going to be more and more elderly people. The number of people over 65 will grow every year as the baby boomers cross that threshold. But the other problem is that we spend more and more on healthcare, and it's rising faster than the cost of other things. We spend more on healthcare per person than any other country in the world, and we don't have the healthiest population. So I think that where we have to focus is on how do we make our healthcare system more efficient, and how do we make sure that people get the care they need, but may not be all the care that they want or that the healthcare providers would like to sell them. That's an incredibly easy thing to say and an incredibly difficult thing to accomplish, and there's a lot of wrestling with that now.
As we have seen, because the conversation's been taking place for 50 years, and even with the Affordable Care Act, many feel it didn't go far enough to address many of the cost control issues in
particular.
Right.
The Affordable Care Act basically does a very good job of expanding coverage so there's fewer people uninsured. It didn't really solve the cost problem, which is why we're going to revisit it again and again.
Is Medicare the program worth the money we are spending on it?
Well, it is if you're an old person who gets covered. I think that, I mean, I really want to answer that question yes and no. Does Medicare do any good? Yes. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that elderly people live better and live better lives because they have health care. And before Medicare was created, we had a lot of old people who didn't get health care. But it's not worth, we're not getting our money's worth, because there's a lot of crazy incentives and waste in Medicare, people being paid to do procedures that may not need to be done. So it's definitely worth it. We are saving lives and making people's life better, but it's not worth everything we pay for it because of the way we've organized our healthcare system.
We don't want to go back to the days before Medicare, but there has to be a balance there, is basically what you found.
I would think so, yes. Yeah.
Same case for Medicaid. You don't want to go back to where the low-income folks, folks with disabilities, were just left to their own devices.
Right. As you know, there's a big argument about Medicaid. How much should it be left to the states to handle, and how much should it be done at the federal level? And then, frankly, the worst of all possible situations is where you have people who are both on Medicaid and on Medicare, and then the system is completely screwy. You're in a nursing home, and Medicaid is paying your bills, and the state has an incentive to say, oh, this person is a little sick, we ought to send them to the hospital, because if they send them to the hospital, then Medicare, the 100% federal program, pays their bills. And there's a lot of efforts going on to try and figure out, for gosh sakes, the government's paying all the bills here. Why do we have one arm of the government pushing them into the hospital and the other arm of the government pushing them out of the hospital? Isn't there a better way to do this?
And there are a lot of people in that category.
Right. They're called dual eligibles, and a lot of them have chronic diseases which are hard to treat and can be very expensive. Mm-hmm. So,
and many middle class people, as if they've spent 2 years in the nursing home, they've exhausted their savings, they've gone on Medicaid, and then it's
correct. Medicaid is basically the insurance of last resort for elderly people. And given how expensive nursing homes and long-term care are, and given that we don't have a very good long-term care insurance system, it's become the thing that picks up the tab for middle-class grandmas and grandpas when they end up in nursing homes. Absolutely right.
We're speaking with David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. His new book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. We'll continue our discussion with David Wessel, and we'll look at the small economy, you could call it that, the small economy that is the Pentagon when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and it is the greatest mass extinction since the dinosaurs. Species by species, amphibians are vanishing off the face of the Earth. Despite international alarm and 15 years of scientists scrambling for answers, the steady hemorrhaging of amphibians continues. Nature presents Frogs, the Thin Green Line. Watch tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Jazzoo continues with A Night in Vegas featuring the Columbus Gay Men's Chorus and Small Ensemble Vox Friday, August 10th at the Columbus Zoo. Gates at 6:30, showtime at 8. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
80 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 95. Partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 67 degrees. Cloudy with a good chance of rain on Thursday, a high of 84. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the federal budget deficit with David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal, and he is the author of the new book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, the Pentagon's budget is $700 billion right now. You write it would put the Defense Department among the 20 largest economies in the world.
All right, the most incredible thing I find about our defense budget is it's larger than the combined defense budgets of the following: China, Britain, France, Russia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Germany, India, Italy, Brazil, Korea, Australia, Canada, Turkey, the UAE, Spain, and Israel. It's bigger than the defense budgets of the next 17 largest defense budgets combined. And I think we're going to have more and more debate about whether we can afford that and how much defense is enough. As you know, President Obama has proposed shrinking the defense budget some, although it would still, in inflation-adjusted terms, be bigger than we've ever had in peacetime before. Republican Mitt Romney says he wants to increase it, although there's a little bit of restlessness among some of the conservatives in the Congress about that idea.
Here's a story that just happened last week here in Central Ohio. President Obama made a campaign stop in Mansfield, and Air Force One landed at a National Guard base where there's an air refueling wing. He had proposed cutting that wing in his defense budget. It would cost about 800 jobs in Mansfield, a city that's been struggling. Republicans blasted the president for cutting that air refueling wing and cutting those jobs. The White House immediately said, well, we want to clarify, we're not going to cut the jobs, just the wing. If they can't, I mean, Mansfield needs jobs. I'm not saying this, but if you can't cut a small little piece of the Defense Department right there in a city in Ohio, how on earth can you tackle a $700 billion budget and try to make real cuts?
You're right. It's a big problem that a lot of defense budget goes to jobs, and the Defense Department and defense contractors have been pretty clever about this over the years. You don't ever build a big fighter jet in one place. You spread it out among 75 congressional districts, so you have 75 allies. You know that at one point Congress, because it was aware of how hard it is to ever close a military base, set up a commission, and they told the commission to come up with which bases should be closed, and then Congress promised to vote up or down the whole package. That was a way to kind of avoid the difficulty of singling out a particular base, and we'll probably get back to that again soon. But my favorite example is aircraft carriers, to tell you the truth. Congress has mandated that the Navy have 11 aircraft carriers, and the Navy says that it wants to replace one every 5 years for the rest of my life. Each one of these things costs $11 billion. These things are huge. They're 4.5 acres of mobile sovereign territory, the Navy calls them. Well, $11 billion is the same amount that we spend on all the hip, knee, and shoulder surgery for 700,000 Medicare recipients. And so when you think about the scale of these things, you really have to say, do we need them? And there's a big argument among the military strategists whether aircraft carriers even make sense anymore. They made a lot of sense in World War II, but maybe they're sitting ducks with all these mobile missiles out there now and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you discover that aircraft carriers are expensive even in death. It costs $2 billion to take one of these things out of service because they have nuclear reactors. So at some point, the military always wants more. And that was a problem going back to Eisenhower. And as a society, we have to figure out how much is enough.
All right. Let's move on to another section of the budget, and we'll let David in Youngstown bring us to that point. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. My question is, the farmers has been making record-breaking profits, but yet we still subsidize the farmers. I don't understand why we're still doing this year after year. I understand why we have Medicare and different things like that, but subsidizing somebody who don't need it? I don't get it.
All right. Farm subsidies.
He makes a very good point. Farm subsidies were born in an earlier era when a lot of people lived on the farm. Back in the 20s and 30s, more than 40% of Americans lived in rural areas. Today, it's about 1 in 6. Back in then, 20% of the workers were in agriculture. Today, it's fewer than 2%. And so what began really as a temporary subsidy in bad times for farms has become permanent, partly because they're so politically powerful. When Republicans took over Congress in 1994, they did make a big deal about trimming back farm subsidies, but 2 years later, they went right back to adding them up again. And we're having a fight in Congress right now. There are some of the direct subsidies are being cut, but we have subsidized crop insurance, which means that even when you don't grow anything, you get paid back some. It's obvious why the farmers want this. It's good for them. A lot of them are not, we're not talking about poor family farmers here. A lot of the money goes to farmers with lots of income, six-figure incomes. But it's been very difficult for Congress to kind of to deal with. And the problem is that the government budget is full of things that are benefiting somebody, and the people who want to save them work a lot harder than the people who want to cut them.
David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal, joins us on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the huge and growing federal budget deficit and what it's going to take to erase that debt, if it can be done at all. David, what other departments? I mean, I look at the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, the Department of the Interior. Are all of these departments necessary? Are they necessary at the size they are now? Where else can we cut?
That's a hard question because what I'm trying to do is to separate out what the facts are from the choices we have to make. And one of the things that troubles me about our budget debate is that people start with a premise, we need smaller government, and then they assemble a whole lot of facts to support it. And so if you listen to MSNBC, you get one set of opinions with the facts to back it up. You watch Fox, you get another set with a different set of facts. You wouldn't know they were talking about the same things. So how many government departments do we need? I have no idea. Do I think it really matters? No, I don't think it matters. I do think that people need to be aware that the fraction of government spending that goes to these domestic departments has gotten smaller and smaller over time. If we fired every single government employee, every single one, from the person who polishes the doorknobs at the White House to the person who's cleaning up after the bears at the National Zoo to the Coast Guard man in San Francisco Harbor, if we fired all of them, we'd save a lot of money, about $435 billion last year in wages and benefits. But that wouldn't have been enough money to reduce the deficit by even 40%. Because most of the money that goes into the federal government goes out again in the form of benefits or, in many cases, contracts or grants to state and local governments. And so if we're going to shrink the federal government, somebody is going to get less from the federal government, and people aren't volunteering for that role.
Mm-hmm. David Wessel, economics editor from The Wall Street Journal, is our guest here as we talk about the federal budget and the federal deficit that has really just almost become too big to imagine. David, we've talked about the cost side. Let's look at the revenue side. How would you describe the current tax burden that Americans face right now and how it compares to, let's start with previous tax burdens in previous generations here in the United States?
Right. Well, as you know, if you look at the actual numbers about how much of our income we pay in taxes to the federal government in Social Security, Medicare, payroll taxes, and income taxes, and all the other taxes, for people at the middle of the middle class, that middle 20% of the population, the tax rate has actually been coming down for the last 30 years. State and local taxes have gone up in many cases, but the federal tax rate has gone down. And the reason that we've been able to lower tax burdens, I mean, they may be paying more dollars in taxes if their wages went up, if they're lucky enough to have wage increases over that time. But the reason that we've been able to continue to spend more and have without having higher tax burdens is that we're borrowing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a big debate about, of the taxes we collect, how should we allocate that among rich and middle class and poor? And what we've done over time is lay more of the burden on the upper income people. They've also got a bigger slice of the income pie. over that time, and we've let a lot of people at the bottom off the hook for taxes. Last year, 46% of American households didn't pay any income tax. A lot of them paid the payroll tax, but about a fifth of American households didn't pay either income or payroll taxes. They just didn't make enough money, or they were living on Social Security, or they were taking advantage of all these tax breaks we've created for low-wage workers, particularly those with families.
Let's go to it. This is Mark from Columbus on line three. Go ahead, Mark. You have a question that ties directly to this, who pays what in taxes. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, your question was what are we willing to do, and I would consider myself middle class. I don't, my income's not very high. But I mean, I would be willing to pay a higher rate, but I think what we've especially been hearing with this presidential campaign and the talk of, you know, capital gains taxes and all these things, and people who are extremely wealthy end up paying a lower percentage than, you know, a middle class working person. And I understand that maybe the upper class are paying a higher burden, but I just think that, you know, if we could get those percentages a little bit more equitable, where it didn't feel like they were paying less percentage because of using different tax havens and loopholes and things that they use too. So, I mean, I'd be willing to pay more, but only if I see reform across the board where it seems like it's more equitable, fair, and simpler and not as confusing.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Let's get a response here. David?
Well, so, on average, rich people pay more than middle-class people, but the caller is right that if most of your income or a lot of it comes in the form of capital gains, which is the profits you make from selling shares or other assets, or from dividends, which are the checks you get if you own shares, you're taxed at a lower rate. And so for those people at the top who get most of their income from capital gains or dividends, they often paying a lower rate. That's in part why Mitt Romney's tax rate is so much lower than, say, mine. There's a big argument about whether that's good for the economy. Does it create investment and jobs, or is it just a giveaway to the rich? And you can guess which side the Republicans and Democrats are on. But I think the caller makes another point, which is really fundamental, which is I think a lot of Americans understand that the deficit is not sustainable, and they are willing to make some sacrifices. But they want it to be fair, and that's really hard to measure what's fair. And they also want to trust the government is going to do its best to restrain spending and not waste a lot of it. And unfortunately, because what's happened over the last couple of years and all the mud that the politicians throw at each other and some of the scandals we've seen, there's very little trust in government. So people are unwilling, many of them, to say, I'm in favor of higher taxes, I'll pay more in taxes, because they're not convinced that Congress will keep the bargain and cut spending and do the right thing and set some priorities and stop arguing about everything.
And as you've mentioned, you know, the track record is just not there. You mentioned Ronald Reagan tried to take away the revenue to try to, as a stick, to get the government to cut spending, and it didn't work. Deficits increased.
Yeah, but there are, it's not like we're without examples of success. In the early 1990s, when George Bush the first was president and Democrats controlled Congress, they cut a deal to reduce the deficit. It meant restraining spending, and it meant raising taxes. Now, the deal is very unpopular, and it's got a bad rap, and particularly among Republicans, it's seen as costing George H.W. Bush re-election because he broke his promise.
This was the read my lips. Well, he
read
broke
my
his
lips, no new taxes, yeah. Right? But the fact is that paved the way for the deficit to come down. Bill Clinton came in, he raised taxes. The economy, we had a great boom then, which meant the government brought in more revenue. And at the end of the 1990s, we were running surpluses. Now, and there were projections that surpluses would go on forever. Now, the projections were wrong. The economy didn't continue as strong as they'd hoped. We cut taxes and we spent a lot of money on all sorts of things. So we didn't get the surpluses. But there was a moment in the early 90s where there was some bipartisan agreement. Not everybody liked it. The left didn't like it, and the right didn't like it. But there was enough people in the middle to be able to cut a deal. Unfortunately, that's not the case now.
My favorite, one of my favorite lines when you're listening to when you're interviewing a politician, when they'll say, "This is the wrong time to raise taxes." And I always follow it up with, "Okay, when's the right time to raise taxes?"
Right.
When is the right time to raise taxes?
Well, but there is. I think you're right, and I think every politician thinks the right time to raise taxes is the day after my next election, right? But look, here's the problem. We have a a real dilemma now. We have a very weak economy. We have a lot of unemployment. The urgent problem is unemployment. It's not the deficit. We're borrowing unlimited amounts of money at record low interest rates. So what the doctor calls for, and this is actually what Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, has called for, is a kind of two-fisted policy. We might have to do a little more now to help the economy, but we could put in place now a program of spending cuts and tax increases to take effect when the economy is stronger over the next decade and get ourselves in a much more stable position. That's the rational thing to do, right? But it just seems to be no consensus for doing that, and it's extremely frustrating.
And then when times get good, we just heard today the revenue projections in here in the state of Ohio, they're coming in ahead of what they had projected. So we're going to end up with a small surplus. And the first thing here is to cut taxes. Now, Ohio has, they have to have a balanced budget, so we can't have deficit spending like the federal government has. But when times are good, politicians, the first thing they do is cut taxes, which in the long term, it does not solve the deficit problem.
Well, yeah, that's right. But there's a big philosophical debate going on in the country, and your governor is on one side of it, about whether we should have smaller government or bigger government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true in states like Ohio and Wisconsin, the governors have shown some willingness to actually cut spending, even if it's not popular. And so at least they're pursuing something that's coherent. What's less coherent are those politicians who basically argue for less taxes, but they don't want to cut any spending. And we have a few of those in Washington.
David Wessel, economics editor with The Wall Street Journal. His new book, Red Ink, looks at the federal budget deficit and what it's going to take to get us out of this mess. David, do we need a catastrophe to fix this? Do we need a Greek-style debt crisis to really get the public's attention, to get to give the lawmakers, the policymakers, the political will to solve this problem long-term?
Well, we solve this one of two ways. Either we have a crisis, like the one you describe, more likely to be like Spain or Italy than Greece, in that our interest rates go up, or we have an outbreak of leadership. One or the other. In the book, I spent some time talking to Leon Panetta, who's now the defense secretary, but in the past was chairman of the House Budget Committee and budget director in the Clinton White House and so forth. And I tried that line out on him. And he says, I used to tell my students that we're either governed by leadership or crisis. And I always thought that if leadership wasn't there, then ultimately you rely on crisis to drive decisions. But in the last few years, my biggest concern is that crisis doesn't seem to drive decisions either. So there goes that theory.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
How about the role of the Tea Party? I mean, they get a lot of heat for not being willing to compromise. But compromise has kind of got us into the situation we are now. I mean, they have cut deals on occasion. Back, you mentioned the George H.W. Bush tax deal with Democrats. But the Tea Party is, you know what, we're going to be uncompromising. We're going to cut spending. We're going to try to fix this. Is that necessarily a completely bad thing?
The problem with not compromising is if you don't have control, if you can't get your views through, then you say, I'm not going to compromise, and you just block progress. So I'm not sure that we really benefited from the showdown last summer where there was a big fight over raising the federal debt ceiling. I think that in a democracy like ours, in some other countries, the president or the prime minister is elected and then has a majority of the parliament. That's the way it is in most European countries. So they get their program through. In our system, the president can't get his program through. The other party can always block it, particularly if they have 40 votes in the Senate. So if you want nothing to happen, that's a great recipe.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think there are things that have to be done, if you think you'd rather have 70% of a loaf than 100% of a loaf, then it's not the right thing to do. The Tea Party is kind of an amorphous group. Some of them are more coherent than others. Some of them, I think, got elected to Congress on a platform of promising to be angrier than their constituents, and
mm-hmm.
they've delivered on that. But at some point, you get elected to Congress to legislate, and legislate means finding those areas of agreement where you don't violate your principles, but you can accommodate the other side in order to get something done.
Which brings us to this December 31st deadline. There'll be automatic cuts if they can't reach a deal. What do you think is going to happen between now and then?
Well, that's a good question. So
I guess I should amend my question. What do you think is going to happen between Election Day and then? Because nothing's going to happen between now and Election Day.
Before Election Day. Yeah. Congress basically loaded a gun and pointed it at the head of the American economy, and they set the trigger to go off on December 31st, unless they could find an alternative way to reduce the deficit. If I had to bet right now, I'd say they'll take the bullets out of the gun, and they won't let them go off. But they're playing a game of Russian roulette here with the American economy, and it's a little bit scary. I think if Governor Romney wins the presidential race, they'll probably have little trouble putting the whole thing off for 6 months or so to give the new president a chance to figure out what his program is. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a much harder for me to game out what happens if President Obama is reelected. He may decide to hang tough and tell the Republicans, I'll negotiate with you, but I'm going to let these taxes go up and these spending cuts take place if you don't bargain in good faith. I don't know whether he has the guts to do that, but there's certainly some Democrats who are urging that on him.
And he's would not face re-election again if he wins in November, so he might have a little bit stronger position to stand on. Well, it'll be interesting to watch. I'm sure there'll be a lot more rhetoric, and maybe, as you said, Dave, maybe there'll be an outbreak of leadership, and we'll get some solutions. David Wessel, economics editor with The Wall Street Journal. His new book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
You're welcome.
Up next, we'll talk to Jack Torrey, Washington Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll get a take on where our local lawmakers stand on this and what's happening in the halls of Congress to try to solve this problem. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can support our station for as little as $5 a month. As a basic member, you'll receive some great benefits, including a one-year subscription to our program guide, Airfare Magazine, a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek Magazine, the WOSU FYI e-newsletter, and a WOSU Public Media Grocery Tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit WOSU.org and become a member of 89.7 NPR News today. And thanks for your support.
Support for 89.7 comes from Kosai, exploding with dynamic exhibits, live shows, 3D movies, and adventures that are made for families to enjoy together. More information about summer fun is at kosai.org/save.
And stay right here at 11 o'clock for Hour 2 of All Sides, an insider's look at Watergate and President Richard Nixon's White House with former White House counsel John Dean. That's All Sides from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. 81 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 95 today. There is a slight chance of a pop-up shower. Partly cloudy tonight with, again, a slight chance of rain, a low of 67. Mostly cloudy with a little bit better chance of rain on Thursday, a high of 84. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the federal deficit. That's the yearly deficit that the federal government racks up, and then that all gets piled together to form the federal debt. The federal debt right now is about $16 trillion, a number that really is very hard to comprehend. To help us understand some of the how Congress works, we turn to Jack Torrey, Washington, D.C. Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Jack, welcome to All Sides.
Glad to be with you this morning.
Jack, candidates talk about deficit reduction, but where is it really on their list of legislative priorities?
As far down the list as possible. They are not. I have not seen one credible plan proposed by either presidential candidate or by any of the candidates in the state of Ohio that would seriously deal with the debt problem that the United States is facing. Both sides are playing to their bases. The Republicans want you to believe that you can continue the 2001 and 2003 income tax and business tax cuts, and it will not impact the deficit. The Democrats believe you don't need to do anything with the entitlement programs of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and it will not impact the deficit. The problem is the mathematics shows that both sides are completely wrong.
Senator Rob Portman was on the super committee. They tried to reach a deal on the deficit reduction. It could not, and that's why we face this December 31st deadline of the automatic cuts. Why couldn't they reach a deal? Why couldn't Rob Portman, reasonable guy, everyone seems to like him, both Democrats and Republicans. This committee had some folks who. Why couldn't they reach a deal?
Well, Senator Portman, I mean, he's a little bit more conservative than his rhetoric would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
He was not willing to budge on income tax increases, and the Democrats were only willing to budge on entitlements. And when I speak of entitlements, I'm talking about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They were not willing to budge on that unless the Republicans gave on income tax increases. So neither side was willing to compromise. The super committee was set up almost from the very start to fail. The people that were put on it, I think Senator Portman was a very serious guy, and he really thought they could cut a deal. But the problem is, in 1 year out from an election, it would have been virtually impossible for them to make the type of compromises they need to do. And they all know they need to do to make the to eliminate the debt crisis.
We're speaking with Jack Torrey, Washington, D.C. reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He covers Congress, in particular covers the Ohio delegation. Jack, any member of the Ohio delegation that is, you said it's all pretty far down on the list of priorities, but is there any member of the Ohio delegation where deficit reduction is a higher priority?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's from Steve LaTourette, yeah, who's leaving.
That was my guess, yeah.
He is one of the very few members in the Republican Party who took the position that you'd have to have a compromise that included taxes and spending cuts. I mean, let me give you an idea. The Congressional Budget Office is the gold standard on projecting the future of the federal deficit and the federal budget itself. It's nonpartisan. They just simply put the numbers in the book based on current law. This is how bad of a situation we're in. If you allow the 01 and 03 tax cuts, which are commonly called the Bush tax cuts, to expire on schedule at the end of this year, we still add $3 trillion to the publicly held debt over the next decade. We do not run any surpluses. The lowest the budget deficit gets to is $196 billion in 2018. Now, that of all the statistics you look at, that one tells you how the massive scale of this problem is. And the denial that both political parties are in, particularly the two presidential candidates, who cannot seem to, and I'm sorry if I sound rather grim this morning, who cannot seem to level with the voters and explain to them the magnitude of the problem.
We're talking with Jack Torrey. He is the Washington, D.C. Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're speaking about the federal deficit, and we have Susan on the line. She's been very patient. Go ahead, Susan.
Thank you. Gentlemen, the problem is not the programs. It's the people. We have to balance our own budgets individually. We can't continually write checks when we don't have money in our bank accounts personally. And if people could compromise, if the Democrats would stop listening to the left wing of the party and the Republicans would stop listening to the right wing of their party, most Americans are in the middle. We want them to make reasonable compromises. These are intelligent men and women. We pay them a decent salary. They get wonderful health care benefits. And we send them there to Washington to solve these problems. That's their job, and they're not doing it. It seems to the average American that the parties are intent on blaming the other ones for this gridlock. And what they're not doing is they're not working together to resolve the problems. What they're doing is, especially in election years, they're pointing the finger at the other guy and say, well, we couldn't get anything done because the other party, and they're both doing it. And we're really getting very fed up with it. As your average person, we say, you know, we hired you in essence. We elected you to get a job done, and you're not doing it. And historically, Congress people have been able to compromise and come to reasonable compromise, workable solutions for the Americans' problems. That's what their job is.
Jack Torrey, why isn't the middle, the voice of the reasonable middle, being heard in Congress?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal, the Republican Party has shifted to the right. If you look at Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon, they were far more moderate than President Reagan and the second President Bush. Today, the Republican Party is convinced, and despite a mountain of evidence to the contrary, that you can cut your way out of this deficit. You can, but you would have to literally end programs such as Medicaid and Medicare. You couldn't do it any other way. I'll give you an example. Just to address the caller's concern, if we eliminated the Department of Defense tomorrow, we'd still be running a huge deficit. That's how the magnitude of this problem. Secondly, because the Republicans have shifted more to the right, the Democrats have become more dominated by the more liberal wing of their party. And as a result, the compromise is much more difficult. In 1970, the first Clean Air Act was passed by a 77-0 vote in the U.S. Senate. Today, you couldn't come up with any kind of legislation that would pass by a unanimous factor because the two parties are not interested in compromising. They're more ideological. Ideologues love to fight. They don't necessarily like to make accomplishments. And people in the middle, what Richard Nixon used to call his silent majority, they value accomplishment over ideological fights. So until the people in the middle decide to take charge and hire people who are interested in compromising rather than fighting, we'll continue down this path.
Jack Torrey is Washington, D.C. reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're speaking about the federal budget deficit and what it's going to take to erase it or bring it down, if we can even do that. Jack, where does the Central Ohio delegation stand, in particular Steve Stivers, Pat Tiberi? You know, you talk to them one-on-one. They seem very reasonable, obviously very intelligent men, but they vote along party lines, like you said, like everyone else in Congress these days.
Well, in fairness, in the House, the House has always been more partisan than the Senate. The House, you know, you have much more stronger party discipline type of thing. But they both will come down on the side of, you know, we need to cut spending before we talk about raising taxes. The problem with that is even if you eviscerate spending, you still end up with a huge deficit. And that is because we want to offer more services than we're willing to pay for. Now, running deficits in and by itself is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there are times when the federal government should be running deficits, for example, during an economic downturn, because you're trying to pump up the economy. The problem now is that you're looking at today a federal debt of about $16 trillion, of which $11 trillion is what we call the publicly held debt, and that's the debt you have to be concerned about. Those are the treasury bonds and notes that are purchased by investors from abroad and in the United States. The rest of it is simply one federal account owing to another account, such as the federal government owing to the Social Security account. The real problem you've got to get to is the publicly held debt. And I see no sign that anyone in the Central Ohio delegation or the Ohio delegation or nationally is willing to make those compromises, because they're going to have to tell the people who voted them in that there are terrible consequences to this.
Well, that brings us to the December 31st deadline, where there will be automatic cuts. It's a hammer that's lying over the federal budget, and $1.2 trillion in cuts will be made automatically, half to defense, half to the rest of the budget. Come December 31st, tax increases will be will go in. Is that going to happen, or do you see a compromise between now and then?
I frankly can't figure out where they're going to compromise. I mean, they have been warned by business people. There was a marvelous story in the New York Times on Monday that companies are scaling back plans for expansion because they don't know what's going to happen after December 31st. Now, if I had been in the Obama White House, that story would have scared the daylights out of me, because he's in charge of the economy right now. But neither side has even shown an inclination yet to move off of their set positions. So if we go into first of all, nothing will happen before the election. Yeah. I mean, if anything happens, I'll be flabbergasted. But after the election, you're going to have a lame duck Congress. We have no idea who's going to be the president. My guess is they'll figure out a way to steal a phrase from John Boehner. They'll try to figure out a way to kick the can down the road. But ultimately, it will continue until the voters say, we're tired of this.
And voters really haven't had, I mean, it could because for whatever reason, whether it's the extremist on the right and the left or the lack of the strength in the middle, voters haven't been able to say, do something about this. What will it take? Will it take a David Wessel from The Wall Street Journal said either a catastrophe or an outbreak of leadership. My money's on the catastrophe. Will it take a catastrophe like the Greek debt crisis to get us to solve this long term?
I think he's probably correct. I don't see an outbreak of leadership happening, but I'll give you a good example. In 2008, Congress summoned the will to pass the financial bailout, the $700 billion rescue package, which is absolutely one of the most unpopular things you could have ever done. And yet it saved the American financial system. The financial system might very well have collapsed in early 2009. Yes, it took a catastrophe like that to force Republicans and Democrats to vote. I remember as they were voting the first time and they voted it down, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was falling like 600 or 700 points and taking people's life savings with them.
Yeah, it was on cable TV. You could see Congress voting, and in the corner, the Dow just sinking.
Right.
Like you're watching a ticker right there just going down, down, down.
Exactly. And they, they finally acted. So I suppose it's possible. They have been warned over and over again by financial experts, by economists, by American business people, that if they allow this to happen, the U.S. economy will take a huge hit. And it could. The Congressional Budget Office has projected that we could go into another recession. Now, that's like the triumph of ideological madness. I can't come up with to even allow such a thing to even be thought of is scary. And unfortunately, we're seeing zero leadership from President Obama on this, and we're not seeing anything from Governor Romney on this. And they're the ones who set the tone. And one of those two is going to have to go back on a lot of campaign promises sometime next year because the mathematics of what they're proposing does not work.
Thanks very much, Jack Torrey, Washington, D.C. reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, and this is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.